You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Up next, JX senior producer Natalie Golay offers a collection of short news features from around our region.
I'm Natalie Golay. This is the time of year when trees are losing their leaves, but for the City of Eugene's Urban Forestry Department, fall also means it's time to plant new trees. It's part of the city's plan to combat the effects of climate change by increasing tree coverage in areas that need it most. KLCC's Julia Bobach has more.
When driving down the streets of Eugene, you might not think twice about the trees lining the road. But for Eric Mullen, that's his job.
The very first tree down there by the traffic signal, that one had been hit by a car and looked like maybe part of the root system had broken and was laying down. So as an experiment, we decided to just restake it, and it's been bouncing back. So the resilience of trees, despite all the things that we put them through or throw at them, they're quite resilient.
Mullen is a municipal arborist for the city's Urban Forestry Department. He's part of a 9-person team of arborists and foresters who manage over 70,000 public trees. Guided by one of the city's climate action goals of 30% canopy coverage by 2040, the team is on a mission to plant 3,000 trees on street right-of-ways each year. Having more trees has shown significant improvements in multiple aspects of the environment, Mullen says. High canopy coverage can mitigate the effects of climate change, improve air and water quality, level temperatures so homeowners can spend less on heating and cooling, and create habitats for wildlife. But it's not just about randomly putting trees on the road. There is a lot that goes into street tree planting and maintenance. Spencer Crawford is the supervisor of Eugene's Urban Forestry Department. He says figuring out which trees to plant is only part of the process. Figuring out where to plant them is another.
Is it a major arterial in the street, and we really need to make space for semis to go down the street as opposed to a quieter residential street? We can establish trees with different kinds of forms that fit better in that landscape. And if the right-of-way space is really small, we can have trees with maybe more upright, compact forms closer together.
It may seem like there's no shortage of trees in Eugene and in Oregon as a whole, but in some neighborhoods, like areas that were historically flat or farmland, canopy coverage can be as low as 9%. That's a huge disparity from other parts of Eugene, with up to 67% coverage. So another goal for the Urban Forestry Department ties into what they call tree equity. Crawford and the team have been actively updating their tree inventory to create a map of every tree on Eugene's right-of-ways.
We're able to go in and do a bunch of on-site planning efforts and realize where there are gaps and where the opportunity is highest. So we're trying to focus on areas of the city where there are the fewest trees right now, where the right-of-way space for planting is the largest, so that they'll be able to give back.
One of those locations is the Bethel neighborhood in northwest Eugene. During a drive through the area, Mullen points out multiple residential blocks that are being prepared for planning down the line.
This is one of the streets that I've gone through and painted T's on the curbs. Those are areas that have been identified where we could plant trees.
But planning, especially near homes, comes with its own set of challenges. Some homeowners may not realize that their property often does not extend to the sidewalk of their street. If they build a fence past their true property line, they encroach on the right-of-way space where trees could be planted. Mullen says there are other considerations to make sure tree planting doesn't interfere with homeowners' property. If a tree isn't planted deep enough in the soil, the roots could expand and break sidewalks from underneath, and residents would have the responsibility to fix it. A new round of trees will spread their roots this month, when the soil is more moist and the conditions are more preferable for planting. But Crawford says there's only so much the Urban Forestry Department can do. Most of the trees that contribute to canopy coverage are on private land, but residents can help.
If you look outside on your street and you don't have any street trees, you can reach out to our program and see if there is opportunity there, and we would walk you through a process to get a free permit to plant a tree. You also have private space, so even if you don't have existing space outside the front of your house, we encourage people to plant trees.
He says the easiest way to reach that 30% benchmark will be through a community effort, with homeowners and the Urban Forestry Department working together to keep Eugene green. I'm Julia Bobach, reporting.
You probably know most sports by name, even if you're not a fan. But have you heard of goalball? OPB's Eric Newman takes us inside a high school competition for blind athletes in Vancouver.
It's nearly silent inside the gymnasium. Players are crouched, 3-on-3, in an area the size of a volleyball court. They wear blacked-out goggles and are trying to anticipate a 3-pound ball being hurled past them into a large net. The silence in the gym is only partly anticipation. It's also the rules. If anyone makes noise, the defending team won't be able to hear the ball to stop it. A member of the Washington State School for the Blind, Lions, rolls a ball across the court and scores. This is part of the Junior Cascade Classic at the School for the Blind in Vancouver. Goalball is the only sport designed specifically for people who are blind or low vision. Jen Armbruster is one of the organizers of today's competition.
Ball is about the same size of a guy's basketball, but no air pressure, so it's about a 3-pound medicine ball. At the higher levels, we're throwing between 30 and 35 miles an hour on the women's side and between 35 and 40 miles per hour on the guy's side.
Armbruster lost her vision as a teenager. At the time, basketball had been her ticket to college.
Was playing competitive basketball when I went legally blind, and so got called actually up to say try this sport called goalball. It had ball in it, so I said, what the heck, let's do it.
She's a 7-time Paralympian who has won gold, silver, and bronze medals. She's now retired from the sport and helps organize competitions like this one at the School for the Blind.
Let's go, Lions! Let's go!
At the Junior Cascade Classic, there are teams from Utah, Montana, California, and Florida. The atmosphere is fun. Players have guide dogs in the bleachers, and no one seems too upset if their opponents score. But it's clear the Washington State Lions take the game seriously as they huddle in a circle with their coach between halves.
I think you should keep going with your spin throws. They're beautiful.
Yes.
You're almost going.
Theo Burkhalter is a senior playing for the Lions.
I have never seen really a sport, honestly, out there that is about sound, really. And it's everything's about spatial awareness.
He likes the part about the game that involves being quiet. Sneaky, he says. One of the only ways players know the ball is coming is a small bell inside of it. It jingles towards them at 30 miles an hour. Jess Jinks is another player on the Vancouver women's team.
I'm listening for footsteps, kind of, because sometimes players want to walk, switch around, trying to confuse you or something.
When players throw the ball, bowling style, across the court, their opponents have to dive to the ground to block it. 12th grader Li Ling Justin says during games, she's thinking about how to cover the gaps between her 3-person team.
Well, what I'm thinking about is where the ball is going to be coming from and which direction it will come to. Will it come to the left or to the right?
Goalball was created in 1946, according to the International Paralympic Committee. It was designed as a form of rehabilitation for veterans who lost their sight during World War II. Another Lions team member is Owen Bowe. He played competitive football before going blind.
When I went blind, I didn't know of any other sport. I didn't even know blind people had sports. So when I found out about goalball, I was thrilled, and I just fell in love with it.
Owen's mom and dad are at the tournament. They like that here, goalball is treated like sports in public schools. Carla Bow says students have to make practices and keep their grades up to compete.
We like that. We like that they're not treated any differently. It is a different sport in that you have to be quiet when they play, and we're used to like cheering and yelling, and so we're like, oh, like you can't say anything. So, but for Owen, it's been great.
One of the administrators at the school is Corey Grandstaff. He went to the Ohio School for the Blind and played goalball in the early 2000s.
You know, there's a lot of other sports that have been adapted for people who are blind, but this is a sport specifically made for people who are blind. I think that's what makes it unique.
Here at the school, he says, goalball athletes are getting a chance to be active, to be part of a team, and to earn their spot.
You're going to have to work hard to get what you get out of life, right? But life can also throw you some disappointments, right? And so, you know, you learn to lose, right? You learn to win, you learn to lose. You learn all these different skills that any athlete would learn.
Washington State School for the Blind Lions men's and women's teams each got third place at the Junior Cascade Classic. They're competing in the Youth Nationals in Texas in December. I'm Eric Newman reporting.
Back in the 1960s, it was widely accepted that Oregon was too cold and wet to produce wine. Since then, the state has built an international reputation as a wine destination. Today, a lot of people still think it's too cold for olives. But as OPB's Christian Foden-Wenzel reports, scores of Willamette Valley farmers are experimenting with hardy olive varieties. And this month, they're celebrating the Olio Nuovo Festival.
In 2008, when Dundee vintner Paul Durant and his family invested in a new Italian olive press, the company they bought it from wanted it to work so badly that they sent someone over from Italy to show them how it works.
His name was Duccio Morosa della Rocca, and he'd been a lifelong miller.
He showed Durant how to get the best out of olives coming off his new 15-acre orchard. And once he got the mill working properly, he told Durant he was missing a golden opportunity.
This new oil is really precious. And in Italy, it's a very big deal. And so people will travel to the mills to get Olio Nuovo, or the new oil.
The first pressing contains a lot more olive pulp because it hasn't been filtered. So it's really tasty, but not yet shelf stable. The pulp ferments if it's not removed.
And so that's kind of how our festival started. And it's an opportunity for people to come out and taste the oil and pick out which one they like the best and just really experience it. And we really try to make it a celebration of the harvest.
Olio Nuovo is the olive oil equivalent of Beaujolais Nouveau, the wine that's made right after harvest every year in France. It allows everyone to get that first taste of the season's produce. Durant says the festival, which runs all the way through November, allows Oregonians to taste this year's olive oil before it's filtered and made shelf-stable.
We'll have three oils to taste. We'll have a Frantoio, which is an Italian variety. We'll have a Koriniki, which is a Greek varietal, and then an Arbequina, which is a Spanish varietal.
Each tree produces olives with a unique flavor.
And that's really the fun of it for us, because then we can talk about, oh, you'd use this Arbequina in a light pasta, or you'd use this Frantoio because it's Italian and it's robust, and you'd use that with like stewed meats or maybe in a nice hearty stew.
Durant's parents bought their 16-acre farm in the Dundee Hills in 1973. And like many farmers in the area back then, they planted vines and were successful. But as any farmer will tell you, relying on one crop can be financially disastrous. An early freeze or just one disease can wipe it out entirely. So Durant says they diversified to olives.
So we planted a few thousand trees in 2005, did really well. And so we put in a small olive mill. In 2008, we had a horrific winter. So lost a bunch of trees.
They bought olives up from California for the mill and started experimenting with more hardy olive trees and different growing techniques. In 2017, the Oregon State University Extension System did the same thing and is now testing some 116 different varieties at a research center in Aurora. Horticulturalist Heather Stoven says the sector is now beginning to establish itself, but there's still a lot of uncertainty.
There are definitely risks to growing olives in Oregon. And so when people call me and ask me about it, that's something I definitely mention, that you have to be comfortable with risk.
Oregon remains at the northern edge of where olives can be grown, and the cold has killed plenty of trees. But she says there seems to be a romanticism surrounding the crop.
There's excitement about it. People want to come learn about it and come to different events that olive growers have.
Back at the sunny Durant vineyard, glowing with fall color, Paul Durant is comfortable with risking a few acres on olive oil.
2013, you know, that's 12 years ago, that was our last hard freeze. We have seen climate change here, you know, with warmer, drier summers, longer growing seasons. At the same time, we've kind of figured out varietals that are better suited for the Willamette Valley. And so we're having a lot more success growing.
For example, in one orchard, Durant has rolled out long sheets of silver foil under his trees. It reflects sunlight back up into the foliage, helping mimic the longer, hotter summers of the Middle East. Still, establishing an olive orchard in Oregon is a long-term gamble. Unlike a yearly crop, it can take 6 or 7 years for a tree to really establish itself, but then it's bigger and can better protect itself against cold and drought. And there's another benefit, one which will take a very long time to pay off. There are olive trees in the Middle East over 1,000 years old still producing fruit. Christian Foden-Wenzel, Dundee.
You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. That's it for today's exchange. JeffExchange.org is our website where you can find these conversations and more, or you can subscribe to our shows wherever you get your podcasts.